I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
We believe there is a space and an opportunity here to have a bipartisan, reasonable budget agreement that, again, the House and the Senate can vote on, and that we can get the business of the American people done.
Negotiations are continuing in Washington over raising the debt ceiling in order to prevent the United States from defaulting on its debt for the first time in history. We'll talk to economist Jeffrey Sachs about America's wars and the U.S. debt crisis. Then, blood on his hands. We look at a shocking new investigation by Nick Terse of The Intercept.
I spoke with more than 75 Cambodian witnesses and survivors of U.S. military attacks, and they revealed that Henry Kissinger is responsible for more civilian deaths in Cambodia than was previously known.
As Henry Kissinger turns 100 years old Saturday, we'll also speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin, author of the book Kissinger's Shadow. His latest article headlined Henry Kissinger, a War Criminal Still at Large at 100. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In South Carolina, Republican lawmakers have approved legislation banning abortions after just 6 weeks of pregnancy. The bill now heads to Republican Governor Henry McMaster, who says he'll sign it into law as soon as possible. The measure includes limited exceptions for fatal fetal anomalies, the patient's life and health, and rape and incest survivors who can seek an abortion up to 12 weeks of pregnancy. The latter would require doctors to report the procedure to law enforcement. The bill passed after a filibuster led by five women state senators, including three Republicans, failed to block it. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued an advisory warning of social media's profound risk of harm for young people and calling for immediate action from lawmakers, tech companies, and parents to keep kids safe. An estimated 95% of 13 to 17-year-olds are on social media. Those who are on it over 3 hours per day face two times the risk of depression and anxiety. Additionally, social media could overstimulate the brain in ways similar to addiction, as well as cause sleep and attention issues. Murthy said young people's brains are especially vulnerable to the detrimental effects of peer pressure and constant comparison. Lawmakers have passed a number of bills recently to address child sexual exploitation online, while other measures around parental consent, age verification processes, and other safety procedures are being discussed. Murthy and other health experts also acknowledge social media can help young people who feel isolated or ostracized be more connected to a larger community and mental health resources. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is announcing his 2024 presidential bid today during a Twitter Spaces live stream with Elon Musk. David Sachs, Republican donor and ally of both DeSantis and Musk, is set to moderate the event. DeSantis has been pulling behind Donald Trump thus far as rights groups warn of a DeSantis presidency amidst his mounting attacks on LGBTQ people, black people, reproductive rights, and immigrants in Florida. In related news, a Florida elementary school in Miami-Dade County has banned Amanda Gorman's poem, The Hills We Climb, which she read to widespread acclaim at President Biden's inauguration. The ban came after a complaint from one parent. More than 160 doctors at Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, New York, are on a five-day strike, citing unequal pay with their counterparts. First-year residents in Elmhurst earn nearly $7,000 less than first-year residents at Mount Sinai Hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It's the first strike by doctors in New York City since 1990. New York City Councilmember Jen Gutierrez, herself born at Elmhurst Hospital, spoke about the issues faced by Elmhurst physicians during a recent council meeting.
My argument about Elmhurst Hospital, it's an HNH hospital serving majority immigrant community. Chair Narcisse worked at Elmhurst Hospital,
yes, she did.
Serving immigrants. And Elmhurst Hospital has a very unique program in that the majority of the residents are international. Yeah. So what I am trying to uplift is the blatant connection of serving immigrant communities by immigrant physicians on the level of care that they're receiving to do their job. And we really need to ring the alarm around equity.
In more labor news, the union representing some 1,500 members of the New York Times newsroom has reached a tentative agreement with the newspaper after over 2 years of negotiations. The deal, which the New York Times Guild called groundbreaking, would grant an immediate pay raise of up to 12.5% for the lowest paid workers and raise the minimum salary to $65,000. An investigation led by Illinois Attorney General has found hundreds of Catholic Church clergy sexually abused nearly 2,000 children between 1950 and 2019, a number of cases far higher than the church had publicly disclosed. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul released the findings Tuesday, acknowledging the statute of limitations in many of those cases has expired. The probe began in 2018, culminating in a report that's nearly 700 pages long, detailing how 450 clerics in Illinois' six dioceses, including the prominent Archdiocese of Chicago, abused hundreds of children with impunity for the past 70 years. The report also accuses Catholic leaders of covering up the abuse. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, will sell the gift-sharing website Giphy to Shutterstock for $53 million at a loss of over $260 million after an order by British antitrust regulators. In other antitrust news, a federal judge has ordered American Airlines and JetBlue to end their partnership in the Northeast, siding with the Justice Department, which argued the alliance would reduce competition and lead to higher costs for travelers. The Justice Department also has a pending anti-monopoly suit against the $3.8 billion merger of JetBlue and fellow budget carrier Spirit Airlines. In Australia, family members and supporters of Julian Assange rallied in Sydney as they say momentum to free the jailed WikiLeaks founder is at its peak.
It's about Julian Assange, of course, but it's also about press freedom, all our freedoms, and the fact that he exposed a crime that I was horrified about, and he's the one in trouble, he's the one imprisoned, and yet he exposed a crime, a war crime, which no one's done anything about.
Today's action in Sydney was supposed to coincide with a visit from President Biden for a Quad Alliance meeting with leaders from India, Japan and Australia, but Biden canceled his trip amidst ongoing negotiations over the debt ceiling. Julian Assange's wife, Stella, called on Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to do more to secure the release of her husband, an Australian national, as his health rapidly deteriorates inside London's Belmarsh prison, where he awaits possible extradition to the U.S. to face espionage and hacking charges, facing up to 175 years in prison if convicted. Albanese has said he's doing everything he can while a group of Australian lawmakers recently met with U.S. Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy to push for Assange's release. China and Saudi Arabia have boycotted G20 meetings held by host country India in the disputed and militarily occupied Kashmir region. In 2019, the Indian government stripped the Muslim-majority region of its semi-autonomous status as it seeks to fully bring it under Indian rule. Hundreds of people rallied earlier this week in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Pakistan's foreign minister, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, visited the region and addressed the Legislative Assembly.
India is misusing its position as chair of the G20, a forum created to address global financial and economic issues, with utter disregard for the Security Council resolution, the UN Charter, and its principle.
Press freedom groups have also called out India's crackdown on journalists in Kashmir. A new study warns the Earth is entering its sixth mass extinction due to the massive global loss of biodiversity triggered by human activity. The report, written by researchers at Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland, says nearly half the planet's animal species are now in decline, but that unlike past mass extinctions, the present one has been entirely caused by humans. In more climate news, countries in the Middle East and across the Gulf region are more vulnerable to unprecedented extreme heat due to a worsening climate catastrophe. That's according to new research published by the Nature Sustainability Journal, which also says poorer communities are particularly at risk. Meanwhile, another study warns nearly half the population of Phoenix, Arizona, would be in need of immediate medical attention for heat stroke or other heat-related illnesses if a heat wave coincides with a power blackout spanning multiple days. Other cities would also be at risk, as blackouts nationwide have more than doubled since 2015, while heat waves and extreme weather patterns intensify due to climate change. Over 130 U.S. lawmakers and members of the European Parliament have sent a joint letter to President Biden, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, and U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, demanding the removal of Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, the head of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, as president of the upcoming U.N. Climate Summit, COP28. The lawmakers, which include Senators Ed Markey and Bernie Sanders, say in the letter, quote, since at least the 1960s, the fossil fuel industry has known about the dangers of climate change posed by its products, and rather than supporting a transition to a clean energy future, has instead chosen to promote climate denial and spend millions of dollars to spread disinformation, they wrote. Meanwhile, climate activists are ramping up acts of civil disobedience and direct action to draw attention to the hastening crisis. In Britain, the group Fossil Free London disrupted Shell's annual shareholder meeting Tuesday, storming the stage and triggering chaotic scenes as protesters confronted investors of the oil giant.
Congratulate yourselves for record-breaking profits, which lead to record-breaking floods, droughts, and heat waves. Welcome to Shell, where you are complicit in the destruction of people's homes, livelihoods, and lives. Welcome to hell. But I, ladies and gentlemen, I refuse to accept your hell on earth.
This week, the People's Health Tribunal found Shell and Total Oil Companies guilty of genocide and ecocide in communities in South Africa, Nigeria, Mozambique, and Uganda. This comes as Just Stop Oil activists have been leading slow marches on London's major streets and bridges, disrupting traffic. In Italy, climate activists with Last Generation doused themselves in the street in front of Rome's Senate building in mud as the death toll from last week's record-breaking floods in northern Italy has risen to 15. In Geneva, Switzerland, some 100 protesters demanding a ban on private jets descended on the international airport, blocking entry to an aircraft exhibition. A Greenpeace campaigner said there was a recent rise of 64% in private jet flights in Europe.
The climate crisis is escalating every day. We see extreme weather, even in Europe. We had droughts all winter long. Now summer storms and spring storms are starting. And at the same time, a super rich, very small elite keeps polluting as if there is no tomorrow. This needs to stop.
In related news, France has enacted its ban on domestic short-haul flights between many major cities. The move, an effort to rein in carbon emissions, will apply to routes where train alternatives exist. And Typhoon Mawar made landfall on Guam with the force of a Category 4 hurricane, the strongest storm to hit the U.S. territory in decades. Most of Guam lost power earlier today as extreme winds and torrential rain hit the island, while meteorologists have warned of life-threatening storm surges. Authorities ordered residents in coastal regions to evacuate, with some shelters already reporting they're at capacity. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, economist Jeffrey Sachs on America's wars and the U.S. debt crisis. Stay with us.
You got the wrong man, going net zero, it's a part of the plan.
We've all heard enough
of your brainwashed lies.
Come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Go to hell, Shell, and don't you come back.
more.
And again.
Go to hell, shout, and don't you come back no more, no more.
Protesters singing Go to Hell, Shell, both outside and inside the oil giant's annual shareholder meeting in London. And those are some of the headlines. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez. Juan, congratulations on the graduation of your daughter, Gabriela.
Thanks, Amy, and great to be back after a few weeks away. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, negotiations are continuing in Washington, D.C. over raising the debt ceiling. The United States faces a default on its debt in early June if a deal is not reached between the White House and Congress. On Tuesday, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy privately told Republican lawmakers he was, quote, nowhere close to an agreement with the White House. McCarthy and President Biden had met at the White House Monday after Biden cut short his trip to Asia. McCarthy's pushing for sweeping budget cuts and new work requirements for recipients of government programs, including Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The Republicans, however, are not proposing cuts to one of the biggest drivers of the nation's debt, the massive U.S. military budget. According to the Cost of War Project at Brown University, U.S. wars since the September 11th attacks have cost over $8 trillion. A separate report by the group estimates 4.6 million people have died since 9/11 as a result of the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia. And over the past 16 months, Congress has approved more than $113 billion for Ukraine following Russia's invasion. We're joined now by the economist Jeffrey Sachs. He's the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, has served as advisor to three UN secretaries general, currently serves as a Sustainable Development Solutions Advocate under Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He recently wrote an article headlined America's Wars and the U.S. Debt Crisis. Professor Sachs, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, why don't you lay it out for us? Talk about what's happening in Washington, the historic possibility that the U.S. could renege on the—could possibly not lift that debt ceiling, and what that means, and how that fits into the budget that Republicans want cut— and the budgets they not only want not to cut, but to increase.
Well, great to be with you. You know, it is startling that since the year 2000, the debt that the U.S. government owes to the public has gone from about 35% of our national income to nearly 100% of our national income, or GDP. And that has been dramatic because we have been engaged in nonstop wars, literally since the start of this new century. Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and now Ukraine. And we have spent a fortune, but no president has said to us, these wars are so important that we should pay taxes. They've just put it on the borrowing. And as that Watson Institute study has shown, and that you cited, the one at Brown University, these wars have cost us around $8 trillion. That's direct military outlays, that's ancillary costs, that's the veterans' medical expenses. This has been a very significant proportion of the rise of this debt. Another significant proportion was the financial sector, the Wall Street bailout in 2008, and the pandemic costs. But the wars have been a huge deal, and it's bipartisan. This isn't Republicans or Democrats. Neither party wants to talk about the elephant in the room, which is that we are currently at an incredibly destructive, disastrous, and I would say avoidable war. The toll is rising, of course, in destruction in human lives, but also in outlays. You mentioned the $113 billion, and there's more to come if this administration gets its way. They're not talking about this in these negotiations. They're talking about cutting help for the poorest people in this country, and to continue the warmongering and feeding the military-industrial complex. That's why I wrote the article, because it's shocking. It's both parties that are not talking about the real issue here.
And Jeffrey Sachs, if you could talk as well, you talk about these as wars of choice, what you mean by that, and also the issue of the pressure now to modernize the U.S. military to face potential conflicts with China as another strategic plan that will result in more military spending in the future.
These are not only wars of choice, the ones that I mentioned, they are wars of lies, because we've never been told the truth about what these fights are about, why we're doing it. Of course, Iraq famously was on completely phony pretenses, but that's not the only one. All of them have been based on lies. When it comes to Ukraine, we knew, our diplomats knew and warned that the continued pressure by the military-industrial complex to expand NATO to Ukraine would provoke war. But they never told the American people that. They never explained it. And till this day, they haven't explained what this war is really about. You think about Libya, again, lies, no explanation, violation of the UN Security Council. You think about Syria, not only was the whole Syrian effort a lie of the United States, it's never even been explained to the American people that this was an operation that President Obama ordered the CIA to overthrow the Syrian government. It failed, but it was extremely costly and destructive. So these have been wars of choice and wars of lies. They are pushed by the military-industrial complex. They are pushed by neoconservatives in both parties. Now we have new drumbeats of war, not only as if Ukraine was not devastating and threatening enough with nuclear annihilation, and now we're talking war with China. Unimaginable. It could end the world. And yet this is normal discourse in what passes for grown-up discussion in Washington, which is not grown-up at all, in my opinion.
And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Ukraine. You've written often about this whole way that the American top officials in the U.S. government, as well as the media, talk about the Ukraine war and Russia's entry invasion as unprovoked. This whole issue of being an unprovoked war.
I noted that the New York Times has used the word unprovoked regarding this invasion 26 times in its editorials, its opinion columns, and its invited guest op-eds. They don't talk about the truth, which is that our own diplomats, I'm talking about U.S. diplomats, including CIA Director William Burns, who wrote a memo that was released by WikiLeaks in 2008, his 2008 memo said, this is existential from Russia's point of view. If we continue to push NATO enlargement to Ukraine, this could have absolutely dire consequences. Our diplomats have known this all along, but it's been the politicians, it's been the military-industrial complex, it's been the big companies that have been championing NATO enlargement. That's a lot of weapon sales if you do that. Even though the risks are completely understood inside the government by serious people, they're just not heeded. And this has been true about Ukraine all along. And up until the end of 2021, Vladimir Putin put on the table a draft U.S.-Russia security agreement that was based on don't expand NATO to Ukraine. And that has been Russia's refrain for 30 years. And yet we don't heed it. And now we're $113 billion into this. It is horrible for Ukraine. We've trapped yet another country in the middle of our lobbying campaigns, because this isn't going to work out well for Ukraine. It's a disaster. It's like how it worked out for Afghanistan. So this is what's really going on. And I wish that the New York Times would carry some truth in this to explain what this is really about.
Well, Jeffrey Sachs, you also have been critical of Russia's brutal invasion. And I'm wondering how you see this ending now. And also, as we started, if you could talk about how you see this debate on lifting the debt ceiling ending.
Well, this war is going very badly. There were tens of thousands of deaths in this Bakhmut battle just now that Russia has won and Ukraine has lost. And the estimates are that just this one narrow battle cost billions and billions of dollars, not to mention the disaster of how many deaths. So they're running through money like there is no tomorrow. And if we're not careful, there will be no tomorrow. We need to negotiate a stop to this war, whether it's an armistice or a real peace agreement. That is what China's saying. That's what Brazil is saying. That's what South Africa is saying. That's what India is saying. Major countries around the world that aren't part of this NATO-Russia conflict are saying stop before this completely engulfs the whole world, which it is at risk of doing. So I think that moving to negotiations now, whether it's stopping the fighting and freezing the lines, whether it is really a peace agreement based on Russia leaves and NATO doesn't go in. This has been the core issue from the very beginning. This is feasible and the world is demanding it outside of this so-called Western, what's really NATO and U.S. allied world versus Russia. So that, I think, is how we could spare lives, save the world, and help the budget, by the way. When it comes to these negotiations on the debt ceiling, I really hope that these negotiators face up to the fact that our military budget, which is 40% of worldwide military spending, is brought dramatically under control, because that's really how to save money. We are 40% of the world total military spending right now, and more than the next 10 countries combined. We've got to get this military industrial lobby under control, but it's hard to do because it's a bipartisan affair. The Congress and the White House on both sides is beholden to this all seemingly all-powerful lobby, but this all-powerful lobby is driving us to ruin.
And Jeff Sachs, I have one final question about the both the wars in Afghanistan that the United States, where the United States backed the Mujahideen forces against when the Afghanistan was occupied by the Soviet Army. Many of those guerrillas that the U.S. backed ended up returning to their Arab and African countries and became the basis of jihadist groups like al-Qaeda. There was the unexpected blowback of that U.S. support of that war in Afghanistan. Are we potentially seeing a similar blowback from the war in Ukraine, which has been a country that's become a magnet even before the Russian invasion for neo-Nazi and ultra-right groups from Europe and even the U.S.? Could these foreign fighters now battling in Russia and Ukraine become a danger to European democracies in the future?
Of course, and it's a very well-put point, but I would say something even more stunning about this. It used to be said for decades that the U.S. backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to confront the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. But Zbigniew Brzezinski let us know the truth a few years ago before he passed away. And that was that the U.S. supported the Mujahideen first as bait to induce the Soviet Union to invade. We started it. We started arming an insurrection to help pull the Soviet Union into an invasion in Afghanistan. It's shocking in its cynicism. And it left that country at nonstop war and destruction from 1979 until today, a completely ruined, wrecked, hunger-ridden, famine-ridden society more than 40 years because the U.S. was playing a covert game with all the backlash that you note rightly, that it created Al-Qaeda. It created so many disasters down the road, but it started as a great game, as if this were a game.
Jeffrey Sachs, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. We'll link to his recent pieces